Sol said. I had to shoot him, Papa. He was drawed down on you. I had to do it.
What the hell are you doing here? Zek demanded. I told you to stay in Punta Raza with your mama.
I wanted to come, Papa. I wanted to be here with you.
Well, what's did is did, Zek said, his voice calmer. And I guess it's a good thing you did sneak along. If you hadn't, that bastard would have blowed my head off instead of my foot. Now, thank you for that, Sol.
Zek limped to his horse as one man rode into the circle and said,
There's four men chained in that damn barn, and them cows has got every brand on them you can think of, including McIvy.
That's it, Zek said. Somebody take the chains off them men and set them free. And the rest of you herd these varmints to the nearest tree and string them up. Then we'll set fire to this whole stinking place and burn all of it to the ground.
McGraw spoke up.
You fellas wouldn't do something like that to an old army buddy, would you? I lost my leg fighting for the Rebs in the war.
That ain't what they say in Punta Raza, Zek said. Word is you were a damn deserter and plundered every homestead you could find without a man there to protect it. And you've been at it ever since, back shooting included. You can take what's coming to you now like a man, or you can whine like a baby, whichever you choose. It's up to you.
To hell with you, McGraw bellowed. Damn all of you. You'd have never took us, hadn't you snuck in here like shitting wolves. Go on and do it and be done with it.
We will, Zek retorted, and you'll be the first. I'd put the rope on you myself if I could walk.
As the men started herding the captives away, Frog said,
I need a little help, Mr. Zek. I got a hole in my shoulder.
And I got a foot that pure hurts like hell, Zek said. Sol, get down off there and see to Frog. Then help me tie a cloth to my leg to stop the bleeding. Then we better hightail it back to Punta Raza. They got a doctor there now.
Sol tore up his shirt and made a compress for Frog's wound. Then he bound Zek's foot and leg. Fires leaped up all around them as they mounted the horses, and at the edge of the east woods, men dangled from the limbs of an oak. One of the men from Arcadia rode up and spoke for the first time.
We'll take the rest of our money now. Everybody's dead. Anything else you want us to do?
Frog handed him a sack of gold as Zek responded, No, that's it. We've done what we came for. You can leave any time you want.
Thanks,
the man said, before he galloped away.
That bunch'll all probably kill each other before it's over, Frog said. I sure wouldn't want to be the one toting a sack of money.
Me either, Zek said. But right now let's make these horses burn dust. My foot feels like every bone in it is broke.
As they rode off, the men from Arcadia came back into the compound, drew knives, and started hacking huge chunks from the roasted steer. Then they turned their attention to the nearby whiskey still. Zek lay on a cot as the doctor examined his foot. Frog was already bandaged, and Glenda hovered over Zek as the doctor shook his head and said, I've never seen one like this before. That bullet is buried in bone with just a tip showing. There's no way I can get it out. I just don't have the tools to do it. Only thing I can do, if you say so, is to take off the foot part way up your leg.
Hellfire, no, Zek roared. You ain't going to do no such thing. Where's a doctor who can do what needs to be did?
Not anywhere around here, maybe in Jacksonville. And you might have to go all the way to Atlanta to find one. It's going to take a bone specialist with the proper know-how and tools. But you better do something. That bullet stays in there, you'll never walk on that foot again. And you'll probably get lead poisoning.
Damn,
Zek shrieked as the doctor poured whiskey into the open wound. Then he said, There ain't no way I can stand this much longer. I'd never make it to Jacksonville, much less Atlanta.
You've got to try, Zek, Glenda pleaded. We've got to do something.
For a moment, Zek dropped into deep thought, and then he said, I know what I'll do. I'll go to the same doctor what saved Papa, the Seminole medicine man.
What the hell? The doctor said. A medicine man? What's he going to do, dance around in a circle shaking rattles? You best either let me take the foot off or head straight for Jacksonville or Atlanta. Medicine man.
Zek ignored the doctor as he said, Sol can ride down there with me, and Glenda, you stay here and tend to Frog till he can ride. Me and Sol will come straight on back to the hammock from the Indian village.
Your friend ought to be able to ride in a buckboard in 4 or 5 days, the doctor said. His bullet went clear through, but it busted some ribs. He'll have to be careful for a good while.
Don't worry about us, Mr. Zek, Frog said. We'll be fine. Soon as I can move about, me and Miss Glendale will go on back to the place. We'll see you there.
Zek, are you sure this is what you want to do?
Glenda asked, deeply concerned.
If the doctor here can't help you, what can a medicine man do?
He saved Papa, that's for sure. And he'll do the same for me.
I sure as hell ain't going to hobble around the rest of my life on a wooden stump. I'd look just like that bastard we hung down there in the woods. Saul, get the horses ready. We need to get on with it.
Yes, sir, Papa, Saul responded. I'll give him a good feeding and some water. It won't take but a few minutes.
As Saul went out, Zek said to Glinda, Don't get on him no more for what he'd done. If he hadn't followed us, I'd be dead for sure. He saved me, Glinda. So just don't say nothing more to him.
I won't. But he sure gave me a fright shucking out of here the way he did.
The doctor picked up his bag and said, I've done all I can, so I'll leave now. I think you're doing a foolish thing. But it's your foot and your life. You better pray that thing don't get infected. If it does, you're in bad trouble.
Medicine, man. Good Lord.
As the doctor left, Zek said, Glinda, go on out there and hurry Saul up. I don't think I can stand this, but just long enough to ride from here to the village. It's a good thing I know the way now. There were times when Zek didn't know who he was or where he was, the pain shooting up his leg like boiling fire. But he rode doggedly, galloping and then walking the horses to rest them. At dawn they passed by the Okeechobee trading post, and in another 2 hours they came into the village. Zek slumped forward in the saddle as Keith Tiger came to him first and said, Zek, Zek McIvey, what is the trouble? You seem to be in much pain.
My foot, Zek muttered. Bullet, the medicine man.
Toby Cypress then came scrambling from a chickie and said,
Father, it is you. What is the matter?
He's been shot, Tiger said. Help him to the chickie while I get the medicine man. Quickly.
Saul's eyes widened as he watched the strange boy help Zek from the horse and carry him gently to a cypress table, the words ringing in his ears. Father, it is you. Then he jumped from the horse and helped place Zek back down on the rough planks. The medicine man was now as old and stooped as Keith Tiger, and he seemed to float as he came across the clearing. He took the foot in his hand and stared at it. Then he drew a long hunting knife from his belt and pushed the blade into a fire. Toby's grandfather and three older men came to the table and held Zek down as Miami Billy said,
This will hurt you, but it will be over soon. Put this piece of hickory in your mouth and bite down on it.
Zek bit the stick viciously as the medicine man leaned down to the wound, his mouth groping, teeth grinding until they took a firm grip on the tip of the bullet. Then the knife was inserted into the bone and shaken back and forth, loosening the lead, teeth locking on again as the old man sucked and grunted. Slowly but surely, the bullet moved outward, Zek feeling like he would pass out from pain. Then suddenly, it popped free, and Miami Billy stood straight, his face blood-covered, the bullet firmly gripped in his teeth. He spat it out and said,
I will make the poultice now. You may limp, my son, but you will walk.
Those were the last words Zek heard before he fainted. You will walk. When Zek looked up an hour later, Saul and Toby were standing by the table, Saul's eyes both puzzled and hostile, as he glared at Toby and then looked to his father. Zek knew why, and he said to Saul,
You heard what Toby said, didn't you?
I heard him call you father. What does this mean, Papa? Do Indians call everybody that?
No, they don't. No more than you. Toby is my son, Saul. And your half-brother. His mama was Tawanda, and she's dead now. I promised her that you and Glinda would never know about this, but what's done now can't be helped. You got to promise me you'll never tell your mama, Saul. You got to do it. Promise me now.
All right, Papa, I promise. I won't ever tell.
And I know what you're thinking, Zek said, troubled. I can see it in your eyes. It wasn't no bad thing, Saul. I knew Tawanda before I married your mama. And I ain't done nothing like that with nobody else. Tawanda was a good woman. A real fine person. And it wasn't no bad thing like with somebody I didn't hardly know just for the hell of it.
I don't want you to think hard of me. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm trying to, Papa, Saul said, tears forming in his eyes. Honest, I am. But I never knew I had an Indian brother. It'll take some getting used to. I'm going to be flat on my back for a few days, Zek said, looking down at what appeared to be a mud pack encasing his foot and leg. And I don't want you two standing here gawking at me all the time. Go off and do something together. Hunt or fish or ride horses. Get to know each other while you got the chance. You might find out you like each other. I can show you Peheoki, the river of grass, if you would like to see it, Toby said hesitantly, watching Saul's reaction. The ice suddenly broke. Saul smiled and said, I'd like that. And I'll bet my marsh tacky can outrun yours. We'll see, Toby responded as they both scrambled for the horses. Zek smiled too as he watched them gallop away. He said, I wish I could go with you. I'd like to see it again myself. Toby's grandfather came to the Chickie and said,
It's good those two have gone away together. I was afraid they would hate each other.
I was too. Maybe boys can accept things grown folks can't. They might end up friends.
That is the way it should be. But tell me now, how did you come to have that bullet in you?
We wiped out that pack of varmints in the 10,000 Islands, and one of them put it there. They're all dead, so you don't have to worry about them no more. You can tell your people to go there now whenever they like, and they won't find trouble.
I will do this gladly. It took great courage for you to go against those men. Nobody else would.
It was no big deal at all. We took them by surprise and ended it real quick. Zek became silent for a moment, and then he said, I have been thinking of something ever since you came to my place to pay respects to Papa and told me about Tawanda. You'll have to help me with it.
What is that?
I'm going to give money to the man at the Okeechobee trading post so he can hire a stonecutter to make a marker for Tawanda's grave. I'll draw a map, and he can bring it down here in an ox cart. You'll have to show him where to put it.
Tawanda is resting in the Seminole way, in the casket on top of the ground.
Then you'll have to bury it. I want you to do this for me. I want her buried like my papa and mama. That's the way I want it to be.
If that is your wish, I will do it. I will see to the grave this afternoon, and then watch for the stone to arrive.
It'll probably be a good while before it gets here, but I sure thank you for letting me do this. It'll give me peace of mind knowing it's done.
Zek suddenly felt overwhelmed with tiredness. He said,
I hope them boys has a good time together. Maybe they...
Before he finished, he fell into a deep sleep. Zek stayed in the village for 6 more days, the medicine man and 2 women tending him constantly, changing the poultice and giving him a strong brew made from herbs. The swelling subsided rapidly, and on the 4th day, he hobbled around with the aid of a hickory cane. Saul and Toby spent all of each day together, racing the horses and fishing in creeks and ponds. One day they killed a deer and cooked it themselves, feasting with Zek on venison steaks and swamp cabbage prepared by Toby's grandmother. At daybreak on the 7th day, the medicine man bound Zek's wound for the final time, cautioning him to be careful on the return trip and rest often. Saul and Toby said warm goodbyes, promising to see each other again someday. Then Zek and Saul mounted and rode away slowly, stopping at the edge of the woods and raising their arms in a final salute.
Chapter 37.
March, 1898.
Mrs. Egg, how are we going to ever put a mark on that big mother? Frog asked, looking inside the pen.
It'll take some doing, Zek replied, scratching his head doubtfully. It's for sure he's not going to stand there and let us poke him with a hot iron. What we need is old Skillet to put him on his back.
Inside the pen was a Brahma bull, its huge hump quivering with fury, 1,500 pounds of hostility wanting to get at the men who put him there. Zek had purchased him the previous week from a Texan who brought 6 of them into Kissimmee by rail and sold them for $500 each. But he hadn't warned the buyers that these were wild range bulls, not domesticated ones. The bull was delivered to Zek's corral that morning in an iron cage mounted on wagon wheels drawn by 3 oxen.
"He's ugly," Glenda said distastefully, astride her horse by the fence. "Mean ugly. I don't see what you want with such a creature."
"He ain't pretty, I'll admit," Zek said. "But they say he gets by on less grass than any critter and can stand the heat and ticks better. It's the common thing, Glenna, and all the cowmen are turning to Brahmas. Besides that, when one of them things is dressed out for beef, he's going to look like any other skinned cow. Folks don't buy meat for its looks. And you won't ever see a yellowhammer that big. Beeves his size bring twice as much money. It's like having 2 grown steers on 4 legs instead of 8.
Just the same, I think he's disgusting. That hump makes him look like he's deformed.
You want me and Lester to go in there and see, can we get a rope on him? Frog asked.
Let's just cool him down a bit first, Zek responded. Maybe by tomorrow he won't be so cantankerous. We'll let him simmer a while and try him in the morning.
I don't think he likes it here, Papa, Saul said. I bet if you opened the gate and turned him loose, he'd be in Punta Rasa before sundown.
Maybe so, but I'm not going to find out. He's here to service female cows, not to run a race slam across the state. Them young heifers will take the starch out of him.
The bull wheeled around constantly, nostrils flaring angrily as he snorted, pawing his front hooves menacingly. Saliva streamed from his mouth as he charged forward, shaking his head up and down, then ramming the fence with his horns and backing away. Frog watched fearfully as the bull rammed the fence again and again, and then he said,
"I ain't sure them heifers can do the job, Mrs. Eck. It might take a cypress pole right betwixt his eyes to settle his nerves. You let me bash him 2-3 times, he'd stop carrying on so."
"If we had some dogs, we could do it," Zek said, limping to his horse. "Else he'd get his hind legs and his nose ripped out. Just let him be for now. We'll try again tomorrow. And Saul, don't you be teasing him. You just make him madder."
"I won't, Papa. But if I could get on his back, I'd break him."
Zek and Glenda rode off together, and when they were past hearing range, Glenda said, "Frog's too old to fool with such things as that bull."
"I know," Zek replied. "I worry about him a lot. I've told him 100 times he can feed the horses and tend the garden, but he won't have none of it. An old cracker like him will keep doing what he's doing till he drops dead in the saddle. There's no way to stop him, and I'm sure not going to run him off the place after all the years he's been here with us. If Papa was alive, he'd be the same way. You'd never get Papa to sit in a rocking chair and take it easy. He'd be out there doing something."
"I suppose. But I'd feel better if Frog would slow down. It's time he rested some. And you don't have any business either trying to brand cows with that bad leg. You couldn't get out of the way quickly if you had to. It's downright dangerous."
"I can still move fast enough to look out for myself," Zek said, not wanting to pursue this line of conversation. "I guess I'm lucky to walk at all, but no damned cow's going to catch me flat-footed, so you best forget that."
They crossed through the hammock and came to the open area of the grove. Zek had gradually increased it to 8,000 acres, just short of his 10,000-acre goal. And now the deep green trees marched over the land like rows of silent soldiers. Fruit was no longer carted to Fort Pierce and put on slow schooners with rampant spoilage, but taken to a nearby railhead and shipped rapidly to northern markets. Zek had long since admitted the truth of Tobias's prediction that oranges would become like gold growing on trees. The acreage was now so extensive it was necessary for him to hire pickers from St. Cloud and Kissimmee and Fort Pierce to come in during the season and harvest the crop. Zek stopped beside one of the trees and examined the acorn-sized fruit. "These trees are a lot better than the ones killed by the freeze. We're going to have oranges running out our ears come fall.
I wish Papa could see how well they're doing. He'd be right proud.
I'm sure he would,
Glenda agreed. They moved on silently for a moment, and then she said pensively, The mangoes should be ripe at Fort Dallas now. I wish we could go back down there. Maybe this time we could build our little cabin.
We'll go as soon as the branding's done. The railroad has been run to Miami now, so we can ride the train all the way. One time before I die, I'd like to ride one of them smoke-belching devils. Just once, and that'd be enough.
They continued on through the grove, enjoying being alone together. A thing that was impossible back in the hammock, where cooking and washing and tending the men's needs took all of Glenda's time. She said,
Zack, why don't we go away together this summer and take a trip, just the two of us? We've never done anything like that, and it's about time we did something just for pleasure. We've got the money to go anywhere we want to go. We could ride the train up north. Wouldn't you like to see places like Washington and New York and Boston just once? They seem so foreign to us here, they could as well be in Europe.
I've never given it any thought. But we could go there if you'd like to. Saul could look after things while we're gone. Fact is, he could take over this place now and run it by himself.
That's another thing I've been thinking on, Glenda said. Saul will be 15 next week, and I've taught him everything I can. He can read and write and work figures as good as anyone. But there's more to learning than that. Maybe we should send him off for more schooling. There's a college now in DeLand.
Sent Saul off to college?
Zek questioned, amused by the thought of it.
How'd we do that? Hog-tie him and drag him there? If he ever got to one, he'd probably get kicked out for riding his horse into the classroom.
Be serious, Zek, Glenda admonished. It's something to consider. Someday he'll need to know more than riding horses and herding cows, and what little I've taught him. You've said yourself Florida's changing.
It's doing that, for sure, and I wouldn't want Saul to be any part of it. I'd hate to even think of him living someday in a place like Palm Beach. Out here's where he belongs, just like you and me and Papa and Mama.
Glenda decided not to pursue it. At least think about it, she concluded. We could do without him here this fall. He could go for a while just to see if he likes it. It's worth considering.
I'll think on it. And if that's what Saul wants to do, I won't stand in his way. But it's up to him, Glenda. It's his choice, and I don't think he'll want to do it. He's where he wants to be.
Maybe so, Glenda sighed. But there are other things in life besides horses and cows.
Zek remembered hearing that before, and it brought back painful memories. He regretted being so adamant. He stopped his horse and said, Glenda, I didn't mean to sound the way I did. It's just that I fear for the kind of life we've lived. It's slipping away. I don't want to hold Saul here if he wants something else. I'm sorry for all I said. I got no right to say where he can live and how he can live. Papa never said that to me. Come fall, we'll speak to Saul about more schooling. I'd hate for him to grow up dumb and stupid like me.
You're not dumb or stupid, Glenda said, smiling at him. You're just the way I want you. And it's time we turned back to the house. I don't want those hungry men to come in and think they'll get no supper. That would make me the one who's dumb and stupid.
Zek shouted, Saul, stay out of there and let us handle it. And Glenda, keep your horse well away from the fence. If that critter comes busting out of the pen, give him a wide berth. The bull had not settled down, as Zek hoped, and now he dashed from one side of the pen to another, his eyes wild and his mouth foaming with rage. Frog said to Zek,
Me and Lester will go in there and try to get him on the ground. If we do, we can tie his feet and we'll have him for sure. I'd like to be the one to stick a hot iron to him, only I'd like to ram it up his rear.
Be careful, Zek cautioned. If we can't get a mark on him, we'll just turn him loose with that one. I don't think nobody can catch him and steal him. That Texan must have had some kind of fun catching him and putting him in a boxcar.
If he did it, we can, Frog said. I ain't never seen a bull yet that couldn't be throwed one way or another. But I'd sure like to see old Skillet standing here now. He'd have that thing down to nothing flat.
Frog and Lester eased through the gate, and the bull turned to them immediately, pawing his feet and snorting. Frog said,
Move over to the right real slow and draw his attention. If he comes at you, dodge out of the way, and I'll put a rope on him.
The bull watched both men for a moment more. Then he was attracted to the movement. He snorted again and charged directly at Lester. Frog shouted,
Get out in the way, Lester! Hurry!
Lester hit the split-rail fence, scrambling. He went up the side like a frightened lizard and rolled over the top just as horns crashed into wood. Frog threw the rope, and the noose dropped down over the neck and became taut. Then all hell broke loose. The bull wheeled and charged away, dragging the struggling frog in the dirt. Zek shouted, "Turn loose, Frog! Let go and get the hell out of there!" Frog didn't let go. He made one circle of the pen behind the flying bull and jumped to his feet when the movement stopped momentarily. It took less than 2 seconds for the bull to sight its prey and charge again, surprising Frog by its quickness, coming at him full bore with no chance to jump aside. One horn smashed through his ribcage and sent him hurling 8 feet backward. Zek opened the gate and ran for the rope, his bad leg tripping him up and sending him sprawling beside Frog, knocking the breath from him. He glanced up as the bull rushed past him and out the gate. Then he watched, helplessly, as it wheeled about and charged the horse, hearing the thud as horns met flesh, then seeing the horse and Glenda topple to the ground. Zek scrambled to his feet and watched, horrified, as the horns rammed into Glenda, going into her stomach and ripping upward, staying there. He heard her scream, "Zek! Zek! Help me!" The bull raised its head upward, lifting her into the air, suspended on the horns as she screamed again, "Oh, God! Zek!" The first bullet caused the bull to stagger, and the second brought it down. As it hit the ground, Glenda came loose and tumbled away. Zek ran from the pen as fast as he could, snatching the smoking rifle away from Saul, firing into the dead animal again and again until the chamber was empty, then falling down beside Glenda. Blood gushed from her mouth and from her open stomach as she tried to speak. "Zek! Zek!" It turned to a gurgle, and then silence came as her head rolled to the side. "Oh, no!" Zek moaned. "Oh, no! Glenda!" He fell across the body, soaking himself in blood, unaware as Lester shook his shoulder, saying urgently, "Mr. Zek, Mr. Zek, Frog's hurt real bad. What do you want me to do?" He finally looked up and said, "Go and get the buckboard. Hurry, and bring blankets from the house." Saul leaned back against the fence, his face white and his legs rubbery as he retched. Then he staggered forward and said, "Is she dead, Papa? Is Mama dead?" "She's gone from us, Saul. Get on your horse and go to the house as fast as you can. Fetch back the shotgun and a sack of shells." Saul looked at his father in astonishment, puzzled by such an order at such a time. Then he jumped on his horse and galloped away. Zek was still holding Glenda in his arms when Saul and Lester returned. His eyes were glazed with anger as he got up and took the shotgun from Saul. He inserted shells and fired point-blank into the bull, doing it again and again until the carcass was cut in half, its entrails blown 10 feet over the ground. Then he put the shotgun into the buckboard and went inside the pen to Frog. Frog was lying still, his eyes hazed but seeing, and when Zek dropped down beside him, he said,
"Ain't that some crap, Mr. Zek? All the things I'd done and got by with, to be did in now by a friggin' bull."
"Don't talk," Zek said, pulling Frog's shirt away, seeing a 6-inch hole where Frog's side had been. "We'll get you to the house as quick as we can. Then I'll send for a doctor in Kissimmee."
"I'm old enough to know better than that," Frog said weakly. "There's no need for a doctor. Did that critter hurt Miss Glenda when he went for her horse?"
"Yes, Frog, he did. He hurt her real bad."
"Lordy me. I'm sorry to hear that, Mr. Zek. I wish I could have kept him here in the pen, but there wasn't no way. He was just too strong to handle."
Zek and Lester lifted Frog up gently and carried him to the buckboard. Then Zek picked up Glenda and placed her beside him. He said to Saul, "Leave that varmint right there where he's lying, till the buzzards pick him clean. When there ain't nothing left but bones, I want you to throw him in the river. I don't want to ever see nothing more of him again." Saul nodded in agreement as Zek climbed onto the buckboard.
and drove away. When they reached the hammock, Zek and Lester put Frog on his bunk. Then Zek carried Glenda into the house alone. He came back out and said to Lester, "Go down to the barn and start a coffin. I just can't bring myself to do it, Lester. You'll have to. And while you're at it, you might as well make two."
"I know, Mr. Zek. Frog's not going to last long. I doubt he'll be here at nightfall. I gave him a big shot of rum to ease the pain, and I'll go back in an hour and give him some more. And don't worry about the coffins. I'll take care of it."
Zek sat on the stoop, his face buried in his hands, remembering, thinking of things done and not done, said and not said, hearing vividly the conversation of only yesterday and the plans that were now canceled forever. He also remembered the day of Emma's death, when Tobias urged him to do things for Glenda before it was too late. He was unaware of Saul sitting beside him until he heard the sobbing. He looked up and said, "Saul, don't ever get yourself tied up with a woman. It's like owning dogs. You get to liking them, and it hurts powerful when they go away. And they all go away. If you get to loving a woman too much, it'll bring pain and sorrow when she leaves you. It's done hurt me twice, and the pain of it is pure awful. It'll never go away. Don't let it happen to you."
"I don't understand, Papa," Saul said, wiping away the tears. "Wasn't you glad to live with Mama?"
"That's just it, son. I liked it too much. And now that it's all done, I'm not sure the joy of it can overcome the pain and sorrow."
"I still don't understand," Saul said, perplexed.
"I hope you don't ever have the feel of it and have to understand. Maybe it won't come to you like it has to me. And besides that, I know I'm not making sense. I didn't expect nothing like this to happen, Saul. I don't know what I'm going to do without you, Mama. I don't rightly know if I can make it or not, or even if I want to try."
"We'll be fine, Papa," Saul said, putting his arm around Zek's shoulder. "Mama would want us to try. She wouldn't give up on nothing, and you know that. I'll learn to cook and wash and do all the things she did for us. We'll make out somehow, Papa."
"That's not exactly the part of her I'll miss," Zek said, knowing now he would have to carry on for Saul's sake, whether he wanted to or not. "But the stuff you're talking about we can't do, and run this place, too. We need a man to replace Frog and a woman to do the rest of it. I'll go first to Fort Drum and tell Glenda's folks about this. Then I'll go to Fort Pierce and see if I can hire somebody with a wife to come live with us. If I can't get somebody there, I'll try Kissimmee. But we can talk about this later. Right now I need to look in on Frog." Frog had moments of delirium and moments of rationality, and it was just after dark when he emerged from the fog and opened his eyes, seeing Zek sitting beside the bunk. He smiled, and then he said,
"Mr. Zek, I want to ask a favor of you."
"Sure, Frog, anything you say."
"I come here to help on one cattle drive, the first one your papa made to Punta Raza, and I've been here ever since. This hammock's the only home I've had since before the war. I'd like to be buried right alongside Mr. Tobias and Miss Emma. Don't put me way off in the woods by myself, Mr. Zek, please. Don't do it.
You'll rest right next to Mama and Papa. But I would have done that even if you hadn't asked."
"That's not all of it, Mr. Zek. I got a good bit of gold over yonder in my locker, and I want you to take it and get me a headstone like the ones over the other graves. I've been here so long now, I feel like part of the family, and I'd like the stone to say, 'Frog McIvy.' When old Skillet dies, his is going to say, 'Skillet McIvy,' and that's what I want to. Would it be too much of a shame to you if you did this for me?"
Zek reached down and touched the gnarled hand. "It wouldn't be a shame at all, Frog.
You're as much family as anybody, and I'll be right proud to get the stone just the way you want it. Mama and Papa will like it, too. And so will Glenda.
And thank you, Mr. Zeke,
Frog said, smiling again.
I'll tell Mr. Tobias you've done a good job here after he was gone. And about all them trees you planted. He'll be right pleased.
He drifted away again. And 15 minutes later, he was dead. It took Zack and Lester and Saul 2 hours after daybreak to dig the holes, and then the coffins were brought to the gravesite, one by one, and lowered into the ground. The three of them stood there silently as birds chattered above them, Zack's eyes now dry because all the tears had flooded out of him the night before, as he struggled alone to put the wedding dress on Glenda. A red fox suddenly popped out of a bush, stared at the subdued assembly for a moment, and then scurried away. Zack finally said, "Lord, I'm not going to say much about this, because if I do, I'm not sure I can stand it. Seems a man is born into life just to suffer and bear grief, and I done suffered enough of it. I want you to forgive me for buying that damn bull, because all I'd done it for was to make money. And I'll never do nothing like that again, so help me, Lord, I promise it. But it's too late now to help Glenda and Frog. They suffered because of what I'd done. Lord, bless Glenda. She was as fine a woman as you ever made, and I loved her truly, although I'd done a thing that might make it look otherwise. But that was my doing, not hers. And I'm glad she never knew about it. And bless old Frog, too. He done the best he could, Lord. The best he could. Make them a home with Mama and Papa. And see to it they're happy now. Amen." Zack then turned to Saul. "I'm going to go now, son, to Fort Drum first and then to Fort Pierce. When you and Lester get done covering the graves, I want you to get all the flowers you can find in the woods and put them on your mama's grave. She liked pretty things. And she'd appreciate you doing this. And I would, too." After talking with Glenda's father at the store, Zack turned the horse south, counting each step, measuring the distance of 2 miles. It was still there, just as it was 18 years ago, the cypress stand where he stopped on their wedding day to wash sweat from his face. He dismounted and walked beneath the trees, dropping down and dipping his hands into the same spring. Then he walked to the palmetto clump, the one where Glenda sat on a blanket waiting for him to find her, then beckoning him. He heard the words as strongly as if just spoken. "Don't you realize we're married now, Zack? We don't have to wait any longer." He sat on the ground, on the exact spot they spent their wedding night, remembering, seeing her on Ishmael with him at the Fort Drum frolic, overwhelming him with the smell of lilacs, feeling her softness as he locked his arms around her, holding her gently in the saddle. It suddenly came out of him. All the tears he thought were gone forever. All the pent-up grief that numbed him as he stood looking down at a cypress box that would someday rot and become only a minute part of this vast earth he had roamed since boyhood. He said softly, "Oh, God, Glenda, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry." Then he got up and rode away. Chapter 38. Summer, 1905. A thunderhead formed in the north as Zack plunged his horse into Turkey Creek, heading for the north corral some 5 miles from the hammock. He rode with anticipation, wanting to see the new purebred Hereford bull that had been picked up at the railroad and taken straight to the corral for branding before release on the north range. He watched the sky as he rode briskly, hoping to beat the rain, and soon he came to a small pen off to the left of a barn. Saul and Lester were there, along with the man who replaced Frog, Tim Lardy. Saul watched his father ride up and dismount. Then he came to him and said, "He's a real beauty, Papa. He ought to be worth every cent we paid for him." Zek walked to the pen and gazed at the polled bull, a sleek creature weighing 1,500 pounds, deep red with white splotches on its head and legs, hornless, with a ring in its nose so it could be led easily. Compared to the Brahma that wreaked such havoc and death, the Hereford was as docile as a house cat. It paid no heed as Lester ran a curry comb across its back. The letters MCI were freshly burned on its left rear flank. "He's sure a fine one," Zek said. "And I think you're right, Saul. He's worth the money. Beeves bred from him ought to bring a mighty fair price. I'm glad we've got all of them young heifers to put with him as soon as they come in heat." Thunder rumbled across the prairie as lightning flashed in the north, and soon the wind picked up, blowing loose hay from the barn door. Saul said, "Gonna rain soon, Papa. We best head back to the house, else we get a drenching." "You and the rest go on," Zek said. "I'll stay here a short while and ride in after you. I want to look some more. After we turn him loose, he'll be interested in them heifers, and he won't be as easy to catch up to. It starts to rain, I'll put him in the barn and ride on in as soon as I can." "All right, Papa. We'll see you back at the house." The drive in the summer of 1898 had been the last for McIvey cattle, and it was the one that set Zek on a new course, concentrating on smaller numbers of quality beeves and abandoning the scrawny yellowhammers. All shipments to market were now made by rail, and the old trails leading to Punta Rasa were a thing of the past, bush-covered but not forgotten. It was during the trip after Glenda's death to find a new hand and a housekeeper that Zek learned in Fort Pierce of the sinking of the U.S. battleship Maine in Havana Harbor and the impending war. He was advised to get his cattle to Punta Rasa as soon as possible, since the war would put an end to the market there. Although consumed with grief and not really caring, he knew he must do something with the cows, so he decided to make the drive as soon as the herd was assembled. Before the roundup was half finished, war was declared on Spain, and when finally they set out for Punta Rasa, it was too late. A rider on the prairie told Zek to turn away, for no further shipments were being made and the market was closed, but that the army was buying cattle at Fort Brooke outside Tampa, the embarkation port for troops being sent to Cuba. It was a small herd of 900 beeves, and when they reached Fort Brooke in June, all were sold at an inflated government price of $40 each, more than twice what they would have brought in Punta Rasa. The beef would be used as food for soldiers stationed there and in Tampa. A great wall of smoke blocked the sky in the west, making Zek think the port city was burning. And when he asked a soldier about this, he was told it came from fires set to drive flies from the army camps and corrals. The boom of cannon fire was constant, and this, he was told, was to disperse germs. Malaria, typhoid fever, and yellow fever had broken out in the camps, and all the smoke, fire, and commotion were used to battle the diseases. They decided to ride into the port to see the ships assembled there to transport the troops to Cuba, and along the railroad tracks they passed hundreds of boxcars backed up one to another, filled with war supplies, rotting food and men, army volunteers who were there without uniforms or guns, sweltering in the torrid heat and throwing up all over each other. The tracks were also lined with prostitutes, beckoning the miserable men to come into tents dotting nearby fields. The army camps stretched from Ybor City into Tampa, and streets there were also crowded with prostitutes, competing with men and boys selling everything from stale lemonade to Cuban cigars. Barrels of burning tar lined the streets and again were used to drive away flies and germs. They rode past the port docks, seeing lines of steamers awaiting the troops. Then they went onto the grounds of the Tampa Bay Hotel, now occupied with army officers and their wives, curious tourists who had come to gawk at the war activities, newspaper correspondents, hucksters of all kinds, and more prostitutes doing a brisk business with all of them. The huge garish building with its strange turrets reminded Zek of what he had seen at Palm Beach, and the entire city seemed to be a repulsive, grotesque circus, not a place of serious preparation for war. He turned away in disgust, and they made a hasty retreat from Tampa back into the countryside. Zek swore he would never again go into any town other than Fort Pierce or Kissimmee, and this was a promise he would keep. The year after this final drive, Zek finished fencing all of the McIver land, finally putting an end to the fence cutting by hiring 8 men from Arcadia to patrol the property with orders to shoot to kill. After 2 months on the job, and the wounding of 5 would-be cutters and the killing of 2, it all stopped. Then the gunslingers rode away. 20,000 acres were eventually put into orange trees, and the other 10,000 used for cattle. Zek upgraded his herd by mixing the range cows with Herefords, gradually breeding his cows to 7/8 pure Hereford blood, but he never again purchased a Brahma, the bitter memories lingering on. He planted winter grass for the cows, and supplemented the summer feeding with hay and grains, discontinuing the practice of letting herds graze freely across the prairies and following them, although other cowmen still roamed constantly until market time. And because he isolated his cattle from wandering range herds, he escaped the devastation other cowmen received when tick fever first became rampant, wiping out entire herds. He was the first to build his own dipping vat to kill ticks, doing it voluntarily at a time when most ranchers bitterly resisted such a practice because of its cost and the fact that taxmen would come to the vats and count cattle for tax rolls, a thing they could not do with wandering prairie herds and those kept wild in swamps. Zek figured it was best to spend the dipping money and pay the cattle tax rather than risk losing everything, and it paid off for him. When other cowmen were losing herds, giving up and abandoning the land, his healthy steers brought $40 and $50 each. He made 4 trips back to Okeechobee to see Toby and also to buy the land where the custard apple forest was located. For $10,500 in gold, he purchased 70,000 acres stretching from the lake's southwest shore to the edge of the Great Cypress Swamp. Glenda had been fascinated by his tales of the place, and wanted to see it, but he had never taken her there because of the nearby Indian village, fearing that she would somehow learn of Tawanda and Toby. He bought it because of not taking her there, wanting to leave it in its natural state and be sure that no one ever put axes or machines to it, destroying it as the land was destroyed around Palm Beach. He suspected this was also happening at Miami, but he had not returned there to see. All of the improvements he made to the orange grove and the cattle operation he made for Saul, not for himself. After Glenda's death, he had no use for money or any desire for anything except to build something better for Saul, his only remaining link with Glenda and all things past. Surplus money from oranges and cattle still went into trunks stored in the old house. He also offered to send Saul away to college as he promised Glenda, but the offer was firmly refused. Saul had no interest in further schooling, wanting only to stay on the land and be with his father. As the first drops of rain pelted down, Zek hooked one finger through the nose ring and led the bull into the barn, guiding it as easily as he would a horse. He put it in a stall with fresh hay, then he went to the door and looked out. The soft shower turned into a downpour, blocking his view of the nearby corral, causing him to retreat further into the barn to escape the pounding water. Rain always brought memories of Glenda, for some of their happiest times were spent inside the old house, listening to the patter on the cypress roof. And if it was winter, they snuggled together for warmth, hoping it would continue throughout the night. Then awakening at dawn, still together, relaxed and refreshed as sunlight streamed into the room, signaling a new day washed clean. It also reminded him of wildflowers in spring, prairies splashed with green, orange trees bursting with new life, and plains scorched the yellow color of death when it did not come down from cloudless skies. Black clouds boiled angrily overhead as the rain continued for another hour,
tempting him to stay inside the dry barn for a time longer, but knowing that this kind of summer thunderstorm could last well into the night. Saul would be worried, and possibly come out into the storm looking for him, and the worst he could do was soak himself on the return trip. He mounted his horse and rode away, straining his eyes to see through the deluge, feeling water pour from the brim of his hat and stream downward inside his shirt. He soon came to the bank of the creek and gazed across it, seeing that the level had risen 2 feet, watching brown, bubbling foam rush past him as the creek water surged toward its distant rendezvous with the river. The horse slid and then stumbled as it went down the muddy bank, plunging headlong into the water, causing Zek to be jolted from the saddle as the horse and rider went under and then surfaced a few yards downstream. Zek thought he had come free, but then he felt a tugging as the horse swam desperately against the current. He knew now that his lame foot was caught in the stirrup, dragging him downward. He held his breath as he went under, trying vainly to free the foot, feeling water rush over him, holding his breath until his lungs could stand it no longer, and screamed for mercy. Then he let go and sucked for air, pulling a flood of brown water inside him. A rapid succession of faces and things suddenly rushed through his mind. Tobias and Emma and Glenda and Tawanda and Toby. Ishmael tied to the garden fence, Nip and Tuck baying, Skillet in a clump of palmetto. Frog eating 10 biscuits and asking for more, all of them looking at him, beckoning him to come and be with them. And then he was free. Free of the pain in his leg. Free of the struggling horse and the rushing water. Saul then came before him, and his last conscious thought was, "Don't grieve, Saul. Don't ever grieve." The horse kicked frantically, pulling its load yard by yard across the creek. And when it reached the far bank and struggled upward, Zek's lifeless form dangled from the stirrup. The lame leg twisted grotesquely. After resting for a moment, the horse started home, moving automatically in the right direction, paying no heed to the saddle pulled sideways by the trailing man, thinking only of the hay stacked in bales in the barn. Saul was standing on the stoop, beyond reach of the rain, watching, worried because Zek had not yet returned. In a few minutes he would go after him, wishing now he had insisted that his father come back with the rest of them, but not expecting such a flood. Then he saw the horse, moving slowly through the woods, at first seemingly alone. But when it came into the clearing and turned toward the barn, he saw a form being dragged through the mud, the body of a man. Saul jumped from the stoop, screaming, "Papa! Papa!" He could not untangle the foot, so he ran into the house and returned with a knife, cutting the stirrup from the saddle, and then carrying Zek inside. Chapter 39 1908 Jessie Lardy, Tim's wife and McIvy, cook and housekeeper for the past 8 years, came bustling into the kitchen before sunup. She looked like a white pearly May, short and overweight, an apron strapped to her, a red bandana covering her hair. Saul was sitting at the table, studying a pile of papers in front of him. Jessie put more wood in the stove and said, "I can't sleep when Tim's not here. He should have been back 2 days ago with a load of barrels. He must have gone to Jacksonville instead of Fort Pierce. I'm going to skin that man alive when he gets here." Then, more calmly, "I seen the light and decided I'd come on over. Have you been sitting there all night, Mr. Saul?"
"No, Jessie. I just got up a few minutes ago. I thought I'd go over these deeds and land descriptions one more time before I go."
Jessie picked up the coal oil lamp and looked at it. Then she put it back on the table.
"That ain't so, Mr. Saul. I filled this lamp when I left here last night, and now it's almost empty. You ain't even been to bed. A trip like you got ahead of you today, you ought to have rested. I'll fix us some coffee, and then I'll make breakfast for you."
"Just coffee, Jessie. I'm not hungry." Jessie put the pot on one lid of the stove and said,
"Lordy, Mr. Saul, I sure hate to see you leave. I know it's lonely here for a young man like you, without no girls or other young people around, but how come you can't go up to Kissimmee and get yourself a good woman and come on back here to live?"
"It's not that at all," Saul said, pushing the papers aside.
I can stand it being lonely out here. But every time I ride through the woods or go into the grove or tend cows, there's a ghost looking at me. It's like Mama and Papa never left. And Grampy and Granny, too. I just can't take it any longer, Jesse. I've got to get away from all these faces staring at me. I've got to try something different.
I understand that, Mr. Saul. I just hate to see you go. It won't be the same here without you.
You'll like the Clayton family. They're good folks. They'll be moving in sometime this afternoon.
Saul had hired a Kissimmee man named Ron Clayton, his wife, and three teenaged boys to come live on the place. Clayton would take over as manager of the citrus and cattle operations and be paid a monthly salary plus a percentage of the yearly profits. He had already made several visits to the homestead to study the operation. Jesse set two cups of coffee on the table.
Maybe so, but they're still not you, Mr. Saul.
Saul took a sip of the steaming brew and said, "One thing's for sure, Jesse. I don't have the problem most folks have when they move. There's not much to take with me. Papa and Grampy had only one suit, and they're buried in them. There's a few dresses of Mama's still in there. You can have them, if you want, and see if you can let them out and make them fit. I'm taking Grampy's old shotgun and the rifles, Papa and Grampy's whips, and a few other small things, and that's about it. I'll store it all in the cabin at Punta Rasa. All that stuff's not much for two lifetimes of McIvey's, is it?"
"I guess not, Mr. Saul. But they sure left behind a heap more than the mess of junk some folks leave. You can't haul memories in a buckboard, but they're sure there. And they left you enough to last a lifetime."
Lester came in, poured a cup of coffee, and sat at the table. Saul noticed how much he had aged so quickly, or perhaps he was just taking a close look at him for the first time. He was as frail and stooped as Frog during his last days. Saul watched him saucer and blow the coffee, and then he said, "When you get done with that, Lester, I'd appreciate it if you'll go down to the barn and hitch up the buckboard. Put two horses to it and throw in my saddle. I want to leave soon after sunup."
"Not before you eat," Jesse said emphatically. "I'll fix you a whopping big breakfast that'll hold you for a while."
"Coffee's fine, Jesse. I couldn't eat a bite this morning. Honest, I couldn't."
"You want me to tie Tiger behind the buckboard?" Lester asked.
"No, he's too old now to go with me, but I want you to see to him real good. Turn him loose in the North Range and let him do what he wants to do and give him plenty to eat. I hate to leave him, but he's just too old. He'll be happy here."
"What about your mama's horse?"
"Do the same with it." Saul sipped the coffee, and then he said, "I've talked to Clayton about you, Lester, and about Tim and Jesse. All of you have a home here as long as you wish. If it gets to a point where you don't do nothing but tend the garden or just sit on the porch, that's fine with me. You'll stay on the payroll. I've told this to Clayton, and he understands. None of you don't ever have to leave unless you want to."
"I appreciate that, Mr. Saul," Lester said gratefully. "I wouldn't have no idea what to do if I left. We'll all look after things real good. Me and Tim will keep the graves up, like you said, and never let no weeds get to them."
"And I'll put fresh flowers on them every week," Jesse said. "You don't have to worry about that."
Jesse then started sobbing, and Saul said, "Now stop that, Jesse. I don't want no blubbering. It's hard enough for me to leave as it is. And it's not like I'm going off forever. I'll come back as often as I can to check the books and the sales receipts and see how things are going. So you stop that or you'll have me doing it."
"I couldn't help it, Mr. Saul," she said, wiping her eyes. "I won't do it no more."
Lester got up and said, "I'll go on now and bring the buckboard up here, then we'll load your trunk and the other stuff." Saul was taking one trunk of money with him. The others had been put in one room of Tim and Jesse's cabin and padlocked, Saul cautioning them not to give the key to anyone or let anyone in the room. Saul followed Lester outside and turned south toward the oak grove and the graves. A dim light was just coming into the hammock, and the eastern sky was tinted red. He stood before the five stones, all marked McIvey, two of them covered with wilted flowers. Then he said,
"I'm sorry, Papa, to be leaving, but I just got to go. It's not that I'm afraid to keep on my shoulders what you had to take from Grampy or what he took himself from the wilderness. I don't know how to explain it, but it's a thing I've got to do. And, Mama, I remember that time you wanted to stay in the fancy hotel at Palm Beach and they wouldn't let Papa have a room.
I'll stay there for you someday, Mama. I promise you I will. Grampy, Granny, Frog, all of you. Rest easy. I'll come back to see you again soon.
Then he turned and went back to the house. As soon as the buckboard arrived, they loaded the trunk and the few other things Saul was taking. As he climbed to the seat, Jesse said,
God bless you, Mr. Saul.
You too, Jesse. Tell Tim goodbye for me, and don't be too hard on him because he's late. Unless you take care of yourself, you're about the last old-time cracker left. The horses trotted away, vanishing quickly in the early morning mist. He headed east first, going to the site of the original corral. When he reached the split-rail fence, he stopped and gazed at it, into the empty pen, remembering all those things that had taken place here during his lifetime and before. So much McIvey blood and sweat and tears staining the ground. The corral was no longer used, since there were no more spring roundups of wild cows, but he had given orders to Clayton to maintain it and never tear it down for any reason. He could almost hear the whips popping and the shouts and the pounding hooves of cows and the smell of scorched flesh as hot irons burned into hides. For a moment he saw it all, thundering out of the mist, becoming alive and real again, then vanishing as suddenly as it appeared. He looked once more, seeing only an empty corral. Then he turned the buckboard west toward Punta Raza and left, hurriedly. Chapter 40. South Okeechobee, 1911. The two tracts of land Zek had purchased south of Lake Okeechobee were right in the middle of what was to become the most extensive farmland in South Florida. Saul suspected this when he rode his horse onto the section southeast of the lake and examined the rich soil and the lushness of the vegetation. As he gazed out over the land and then explored it, riding past ponds and sloughs filled with snakes and alligators and turtles, coming to areas of open glades where the shadows of egrets and herons and ibises glided over the sawgrass, his first thought was, how the hell do you turn a place like this into a farm? Upon riding further south, he found the answer. Dredges had already worked here for 5 years, cutting drainage canals across the land, carrying away the water, then using men and machines to strip the land bare and turn it into open fields. He asked questions everywhere, slowly finding answers, learning who owns the dredges and machines, and how much they cost, and where to go and who to see. He built himself a small house on the lake's south shore, and then he set out to transform the land. He hired dredges to gash the earth and drain it, paying with Spanish gold, then the men and saws and machines to rip out the giant bald cypress and the hickory and the oak and the cabbage palm and the palmetto and the cocoa plum bushes, pushing mounds of dirt over the sawgrass and the seas of violet-blue pickerel weed. It took more than a year, but he gradually turned hammocks and everglades into fields stretching as far as the eye could see, soil so black it looked like soot. Then he formed the McIvey Produce Company and hired workers to plant tomatoes and beans and squash and celery and corn and cucumbers and lettuce and okra, eventually becoming a supplier of vegetables to the growing cities of Palm Beach and Fort Lauderdale and Miami and Fort Myers and Tampa and St. Petersburg, also shipping vast quantities by rail to markets in Chicago and New York and Boston. Then he turned his attention to the land southwest of the lake, attacking the custard apple forest with more dredges and men and machines, cutting down the ancient trees with their canopies of thick moon vines, ripping out the lush beds of lacy ferns, strewing the ground with thousands of air plants and wild orchids that soon shriveled and then disintegrated, burning all of it in huge bonfires that blackened the sky with smoke, slowly transforming jungle into more fields that were destined to put more vegetables onto tables in Palm Beach and Fort Lauderdale and Miami and New York and Boston. Some of this land would also be planted with sugarcane. Near the end of the clearing of the custard apple area,
Saul decided that since he was so near, he would ride down to the Indian village. He had not been there since moving to Okeechobee, and he was sure Toby Cypress did not know about Zek's death, and had wondered why Zek never again returned after his last visit 7 years ago. When Saul reached the village, it was still as he remembered. The cluster of chickies, the banana trees, a small garden in an open area to the left. Smoke drifted into the thatched roof of one chicky, where an old woman tended a cooking pot that smelled of stew. Saul went to her and said, "I'm looking for Toby Cypress. Do you know where I can find him?" "His chicky is the last one toward the edge of the woods," she replied, pointing. A woman in her early 20s was sitting on a cypress stool, operating a foot-pedal Singer sewing machine. Two boys, ages 4 and 2, were playing just outside the chicky. As Saul approached, the woman stopped the machine and watched him. He said, "I'm looking for Toby Cypress."
"I am his wife, Minnie," the woman said, eyeing him curiously. "Could you be Saul McIvy?"
"Yes, I am," Saul replied, surprised. "How did you know?"
"Toby has spoken of you often. I guessed it because of the hair. He said you have red hair. And we do not see such as that often. Toby is hunting, but should return soon. Would you sit here and wait?"
"Yes, I would. I haven't seen Toby in a long time. How is he?"
"He's fine."
"What of Keith Tiger? He was a good friend of my papa and my grandfather. I could visit with him while I'm waiting."
"Keith Tiger died 5 years ago."
Saul then became silent, not knowing what more to say and feeling uneasy. He watched for a moment and then he said, "Are those your boys?"
"Yes.
And we will have another in 6 months. Do you have sons, too?" "No, I don't have any children. I'm not married yet. I've been too busy to give it much thought."
"If you do not marry and have sons, how can you pass on the name of McIvy?"
she asked seriously.
"Nothing should be more important to you than that."
The question embarrassed Saul, and he didn't know how to answer since she seemed so concerned about it. He said, "Maybe someday. But I'm glad you and Toby have a family. That's real good. They're part McIvy, you know."
"Yes, I know."
Toby suddenly came around the side of the banana clump, carrying two huge cane-cutter rabbits. When he saw Saul beneath a chicky, he dropped them and exclaimed, "Saul, how long have you been here? If I had known, I would have returned sooner." The two of them clasped hands vigorously, and Saul said, "I've been here just a short time. I enjoyed visiting with Minnie." "You have grown into a man since you were here last," Toby said, smiling. "I have to look up to you now like a pine sapling. But for the red hair, you look exactly like Father. How is he, Saul? I have wondered about him." "He's dead, Toby. He died 6 years ago."
"I'm sorry to hear that," Toby said sadly. "But that is why he never returned. How did it happen?"
Both of them sat on the bench, and Saul said, "He was crossing a creek, and his horse threw him. His lame foot tangled in the stirrup, and he drowned."
"That's too bad. I guess the bad foot must have caused it, for he was the best horse rider I have ever known. He was a good man, Saul, and I hate to know he's gone."
"It hurt me, too, real bad. And I was a long time getting over it, but I don't think Papa hated to go. He never seemed to get over my mama being killed by a Brahma bull. He blamed himself for it. And after it happened, he didn't really have much interest in anything." Saul realized immediately he should not talk further about Glenda, since the two of them were of different mothers. But before he could change the conversation to something else, Toby said, "The stone that Father sent for my mother was brought here since your last visit. Would you like to see it?"
"Yes, I would."
They got up and walked along a path that wound through thick woods and then widened into a clearing surrounded by cabbage palms and pond cypress. Several weathered coffins were on top of the ground and had frames of thin poles built over them. The one stone stood out like a beacon in the middle of the burial ground. Saul walked to it and gazed at the words, "Tawanda McIvy, beloved." He finally said, "It's real nice, Toby. Real nice.
I'm glad Papa did this.
It is a fine stone, Toby said proudly. I come here often to look. Mother would be pleased with the name Father put on it.
They went back to the chickie and again sat on the bench. Toby said, Are you still raising cattle at your ranch on the Kissimmee?
Yes, but I don't live there anymore. I left a man in charge of it and moved to the south shore of Okeechobee 3 years ago.
You've been so close by for 3 years and haven't come here? Toby questioned. Why is this so? We could have hunted and fished together like we once did.
I wanted to, but I've been too busy. Papa owned 2 sections of land below the lake, and I've been clearing them for farming. We're working up north of here now.
Toby's eyes flashed surprise. He said, You mean it is you who is destroying the land?
I cannot believe this, Saul. Father would have never put an axe to the custard apple trees. He loved that place. Why is it you are doing this?
Saul was shocked by the reaction. He said hesitantly, Like I said, Toby, I'm turning it into farmland. People in the new cities have to eat, and there's beginning to be more and more of them. I'm growing vegetables in the fields.
Animals have to eat, too. And so do birds, and so do we, Toby said angrily.
Will your infernal machines not stop until they come here and crush my mother's grave? I hope they never enter this swamp or go into Peheoki. If they do, you will have destroyed us, too, all of us.
Saul was totally dumbfounded, wishing he had never mentioned his work. He said, It's just swamp, Toby. And there's plenty more of it.
It is not just swamp, Toby responded harshly. It is God you are killing. He put the land here for all creatures to enjoy, and you are destroying it. When you destroy the land, you destroy God. Do you not know this? Go now and stand in the middle of your fields. Count the deer you see, and the alligators, and the fish, and the birds. Count them, Saul. And then tell me how many are still there. You have crushed them with your damned machines, and if you do not stop what you are doing, there will soon be no more. They will be gone forever.
Saul got up and said, I'm sorry you feel this way, Toby. But it's my land now, and I have the right to do whatever I want with it.
You are a traitor to the wishes of your father,
Toby snapped, his face now flushed red with anger.
He told me himself he purchased the custard apple forest so no one could ever put an axe to it, and you have leveled it to the ground. He would die a second death if he knew this.
He told you that? Saul asked, surprised. He never said anything like that to me.
Why should he? He never dreamed you would someday come down here and do what you have done. Wasn't the cattle ranch enough for you to make money? Where will you go from here with your machines? I am no longer proud to call you brother.
Saul couldn't take it longer. He said regretfully, I'm really sorry you said that, Toby. I've only done what I thought was right. But no matter what a person does, he can't please everybody. Someone will object. I'm sorry.
Then he mounted his horse and rode out of the village.
As soon as he was gone, Minnie Cypress said, You were too cruel to him, Toby. After all, he is your half-brother.
I had to be, Toby replied pensively. And it hurt me more than it did him. I only hope it makes him think. But I suppose it cannot be blamed on Saul. If it were not him doing this, it would be someone else, and many others will follow. I hate to think of the end of it.
Saul felt physically sick as he rode back through the swamp, thinking of what Toby said about the custard apple forest, the word traitor still ringing in his ears. Since Zek had never mentioned this to him, he could not be sure Toby's words were true, and it was natural that anyone living off the land like Toby and his people would feel the way Toby expressed himself. Toby would soon forget it, he told himself, and they would become friends again. And what little land he had cleared would not make that much difference anyway. There was much of it left, more than anyone could ever use. He vowed he would go back some day and try to make peace with Toby. Saul got up at dawn the next morning, still shaken and depressed from his encounter with Toby. He paced back and forth for several minutes, muttering, Damn him anyway.
Then he went into the kitchen and made coffee. He was hungry, but he did not have the motivation to fry eggs and eat alone again. He ate one piece of stale white bread with the coffee. Then he started pacing again.